This is Jeff Blankford, San Francisco Liberation Radio. And I'm with again, here again with Sarah Jane Olson. Welcome back to San Francisco Liberation Radio after a five-month lapse since the last time we spoke. Welcome, Sarah Jane.
Thank you very much. It's nice of you to have me. I enjoy speaking with you. I feel I can be myself. I guess I've mentioned before, I have been out, in fact, occasionally to confer with my lawyers. Tony Serra has his office here in San Francisco, and this seems to be the place everyone gets together. But I again love the state of California, even though it does cost too much to live here. I'm not all that happy to be coming out here because of the reason I'm compelled to come out, although it's nice to see my family again. But yes, it's nice to be here. The weather's beautiful. I think it's snowing in Minnesota, so I'd rather be here than home.
The latest news on your case in the paper was that your already outrageous bail, which is $1 million, the district attorney is trying to raise it to $2 million because the defense committee's website published the names or the addresses of the two officers who were to testify against you, and because of that, contained in a legally published motion, legally filed motion, they're blaming you for that, and they want to double your website. Excuse me, double your website.
You are well,
double your bail to $2 million. What's your response to that?
Well, really, all I know is what I read in the papers about that, and one can never be sure what one reads in the papers. And that is the truth. I did read it in the newspapers and immediately called one of my lawyers and said, "What is this?" Apparently, the DA has filed a motion asking for sanctions against my lawyers, Tony Serra and Sean Chapman, and to double my bail to $2 million, which would effectively, I would think, revoke my bail. And when we go to court on the 17th, which we had already planned to do to argue two other motions, then this motion will be discussed. And well, I do certainly hope that it works out okay in my favor.
Also, we have with us Barbara Nimes, who is an attorney and a member of your defense committee back in Minneapolis. Welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio, Barbara. And what do you have something to say about this situation?
Thank you for having us. The main thing I wanted to say is that the L.A. District Attorney's Office has never acknowledged the fact that the website and the defense committee are a separate entity from Sarah Olson, and because of that, they've never informed us or even contacted us to remove anything from our website. So we've never been served with notice or requested to remove anything from the website by the L.A. District Attorney. And we do know for a fact that they can get a hold of us because an L.A. police officer did contact us via the website to ask some questions.
And now their names are and addresses are removed from the website.
Yes, they were removed as soon as we received the request, actually within one working day of receiving the request, and that was via a third party.
So in a sense, they are trying to find some reason to get you, Sarah, behind bars, and this is just another spurious attempt by the L.A. District Attorney's Office to do this. On November 17th, which is the day of this broadcast, your attorneys, Tony Serra and Sean Chapman, will be in court in Los Angeles filing discovery motions and appealing this obvious attempt to double your bail. What exactly is going to be happening in court? What will your attorneys be doing besides fighting this particular thing?
Right. Well, there had been a motion that had been filed by Mr. Serra's office that was not argued during the last court appearance when Sean Chapman handled that. And so he will be arguing that. It was a collusion motion between the DAs and various people in the Los Angeles Police Department and several officers saying that a story was concocted that placed me 25 years ago at the scene of the crime. that had never been testified before by anybody to the grand jury or in given in police reports. And so he had asked for criminal sanctions against various people, including the two DAs on my case, which may have to some extent prompted this what could be a retaliatory motion. I'm only guessing, but I don't know, possibly. So that was going to be argued, and now this other motion that the DA has filed will be argued. I thought the main argument was going to be is another motion that has been filed, which is a discovery motion, asking that the district attorney's office fill in a lot of discovery that seems to be missing when one reads through the discovery record, which is almost 20,000 pages now, of interviews that seem to have occurred and then disappear. No transcript of the interviews, various things of that nature, as well as accounting for the chain of evidence. A lot of evidence being used against me now has been used in various cases over the years, certainly in the late 70s particularly, and also has been shunted around the country. Most recently, a lot of the physical bomb evidence was taken to the FBI lab last year in, I guess it's, where is it, in Virginia, Quantico, or wherever the FBI lab is? That's probably the CIA. I don't know. I'm behind on my spy novels. And and then that was brought back to California. And if it's not possible for the prosecution to account for where all this evidence has been and whether or not it's in the same condition it was when it was first discovered 25 years ago, but they plan to use it on me to take away my freedom forever, well, they really behooves them to be able to say, no, we know where it's been, and we have this to say about it, and we can prove it. And so that's the motion they really wanted to argue next week.
Now, when we spoke to you last time, the district attorney was planning to charge you with virtually every crime, alleged crime, that the SLA committed even before you were allegedly connected to it. Is this still the case?
Yes, there was a writ filed to the appeals court asking that that either the SLA history be removed or there be evidentiary hearings on each individual charge to see whether or not there was enough evidence to bring them forth in my case. They did actually take it up, the appeals court, and they asked for arguments from the prosecution and the defense, but in the long run, it was defeated. So they will be able to use the SLA history in some form or other against me. I think that's because their actual evidence, even with this testimony of Officer Brian, this recovered memory, for this particular case is very small or maybe difficult to prove. I would imagine that's why the original conspiracy charge was thrown in. Isn't that always the icing on the cake? You know, if you can't get them on the actual crime, then get them on conspiracy, because the burden of proof for conspiracy is less. And also more inferences can be made from more things. And so I think that that's basically their crowning approach, is to try to get me for conspiracy. And then they can always try all the cases. Apparently somebody at some point always wanted to try that have never been tried. And, you know, I'm being a little sarcastic here, but I do think this is a bit absurd, but of course I would. So there you are. But, yes, they're going to do it.
Now, some things have happened fairly recently, not connected to your case, but to the LAPD. For mm-hmm. example, District Attorney Gil Garcetti was defeated for reelection. And also in the notorious Ramparts Division case, it just turns out that an accusation made against the informant within the Ramparts Division, Rafael Perez, an accusation by a former alleged lover of his that he had murdered three people and buried them in Mexico, prevented Perez from testifying at the trial of some of the Ramparts police officers on the basis that he couldn't get immunity from these charges. Mm-hmm. And now, while the trial is over and the jury's in deliberation, the woman is now recanted. This is casting more aspersions on the workings of the LAPD and their influence on the whole court system and in Los Angeles. Do you think that atmosphere might have a positive effect on your case?
You know, I honestly don't know. It would seem that it might. It depends upon how much attention people pay to it, and also people who really has the power in LA and who doesn't. If it affects perhaps the jury pool, that's great, but this has been an ongoing thing for this entire century certainly since the 40s in L.A. in terms of the power of the police department there. It's immeasurably powerful over the citizenry, and so and the political landscape of Los Angeles. I do know that. I mean, I have actually started reading about it and paying attention to it. So does it really give me hope? It is so hard for me to say. I mean, people say, oh, this is good for you, this is good for you. But in fact, it may not be. It's the kind of thing where you think, well, these people are immune. And that's all there is to it. I mean, you could actually catch them red-handed, and it doesn't matter. And people may be disgusted, but nothing changes. And then, you know, I am their target for whatever reasons. I have many potential reasons that I've thought about, and I'm sure one or all of them or a combination of them are correct. It probably depends upon who one is talking to. Regardless, though, when you've got such an entrenched bureaucracy that is so immune and well-armed, it's pretty hard to feel like you have a chance despite innocence. You know, innocence in the American jury system often doesn't have anything to do with it. Good lawyering does, but I have good lawyers, but lawyers that are passionate about what they do, but you also have the prosecution on the other side trying to win, and you can... And those people are mean. That's all. It would just makes me sound incredibly naive, but there is a deep-seated meanness that I find hard to fathom personally.
And they can get away with things and not pay for it.
That's absolutely correct. And I suppose this motion of Mr. Sarah's was a way to say, you know, can't always get away with everything, but... They do.
It's like kicking them in the shins, so let them know you're aware of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Now, your trial date is less than 2 months away.
Right.
It's January 8th,
right.
Do your lawyers believe that it is likely to begin that day, or is it likely to be postponed, getting continuance?
I think the most honest thing for me to say is that they believe it is likely to begin that day, yes. Yeah. At this point, yes. Nothing is set in cement, but I know that's what everybody wants. So it will probably.
So we're going to leave your case for the moment.
Okay.
We're going to leave your case for the moment and go to the defense for your case and the public support for you, because you have obviously been speaking in a number of places. What has been the response when you've been going around the country talking to people about this case?
Well, I do mostly just go to small venues. I don't deal with large numbers of people. It's been positive. I've been surprised and felt very fortunate to have a positive response from people. Most people come, I think, most people come assuming that, I'm nobody to be afraid of, nobody to worry about, and then have that confirmed. And I've been lucky to meet a lot of real good people throughout this whole experience, and I'm very grateful for that.
Barbara, you're wearing a button that says divest from the prison industrial complex, and you mentioned before Sarah came in that both of you have really been interested in working on this incredibly important issue that the public is not quite aware of yet.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, Sarah, you'll comment about the work you've been doing around that.
Well, I've been reading a lot about the prison industrial complex, and I have to find things that I can talk about, too, in public that don't really touch on my case, but seem to have some resonance with me. And I was always interested in that anyway, prior to even being busted, because I began to realize that that imprisonment in this country was becoming actually a business and an industry, and it was growing like a business and industry, but it was growing over the bodies of a lot of minority people, and it was beginning to resemble again an apartheid system. That had been in place, as we all have to recognize, in certain part of the country in the early part of this century up to the 50s, when there started to be a civil rights movement and then some legislation to start desegregation and basically the racist laws on the book. But there had been apartheid in place, and you think, oh, well, then that's gone, you know, but it started to, it's been reinstituted in the last 20 years in the United States prison system. And the thing that's kind of frightening about it is so many mainstream corporations are involved in making money out of this tremendously growing prison in which the population has tripled since 1980. There are 2 billion people and growing, and it's mostly African-Americans, Hispanics, and they don't commit the crimes in proportion to their amounts in prison. A lot of it's, of course, we all know, due to the drug laws and the changes in sentencing and propaganda that's just not true about how good life is in prison, when in fact states can't keep up with building prisons. They become overcrowded before they even put the final doors on them. And at the expense of the public education and social welfare system, and the very things that may keep people from going to prison and give them some hope. And so Mary and I came up with a poster idea. We used to work in, we did for years work in doing anti-apartheid work. And so it seemed kind of interesting if we could come up with a way with this new apartheid system to maybe kind of tie that work to the present day for us. So we came up with a divest now, people's mutual funds and pension funds. Wall Street is deeply vested in the prison industrial complex. So we thought, okay, well, let's try to tell people that, that we do have apartheid in this country, in the U.S. prison system, and your money is tied up in it, whether you know it or not. I mean, I said that to my husband. I said, oh, honey, we have probably got money in the system that wants me. Did you think about that? He said, oh, God, I know it's true, you know. And so that just, it's sickening to think that, you know. And so we did a bunch of research, and Mary's a graphics designer and came up with a design for this. And we had a friend silkscreen it, and so we have this divest now from the U.S. prison industrial complex that I think is pretty nice.
You're referring, of course, to Mary Sutton, who's also sitting here, who was with us in June. And good morning, Mary. I know you're a little under the weather. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm interested. Are you going to maybe make some kind of connection on your website to this? Because it's really an important subject. We had a two summers ago, we had a big conference here in Berkeley on the critical resistance, and there's going to be another one taking place in March in New York. And I think this is one of the best ideas. This is the best idea that I have heard coming out of this whole movement. People have been talking about it, but in terms of really educating the public, what companies are using prison labor, for example? It's interesting, before they started moving, actually corporations moving their labor into the prisons, not just ordinary, you know, making license plates, the state of California passed a law or removed a law that provided for workers getting out of prison to receive unemployment compensation. Mm-hmm. They removed that, and it was a little item in the newspapers, and that was like, okay, guys, you could come in now because you don't have to worry and we don't have to worry. No worry about paid vacations, workman's comp, all these things.
Unions should get involved in this. You know, I think it really is something to explain, you know, what's happening to workers outside, but at the expense of prisoners inside who have absolutely no way to organize or to defend themselves. And in fact, if they refuse to work, they'd be punished, and punished in the worst way. You know, it's not just a matter of not having a job. You know, it may be a matter of not of having even more curtailed freedom and maybe less services, no food. You just don't know, especially if it involves private prisons where it just seems like civil rights are out the window. And in prison, it's very difficult, even government-run prisons, whether state or federal. But yeah, it seems to me like something that would be of interest in them, because what's the worst exploitation then of people in prison? It basically amounts to slave labor.
Well, yes, Barbara.
Also, I think that small business should be very concerned about it, because a lot of the industries that go into prison take the jobs from the small companies on the outside. So it should be a joint venture between the unions and small business to say, hey, wait a minute, we cannot compete labor-wise or even financially-wise with this large prison industrial complex. You're taking jobs from people outside prison, which puts them in a position where they may have to commit a crime, and so therefore they're now a prison labor force to feed their families.
Yeah, I think probably most small businessmen or businesses, women, are not really aware that this is going on because there is hardly any publicity in the mainstream press about it, and obviously your average small business is not going to be reading alternative media, listening to KPFA or listening to this radio station.
Right.
I think if a program like this can really go out to small businesses, the unions unfortunately seem to be operating the officialdom against their best interest. They're more concerned with organizing votes for, let's say, Al Gore, mm-hmm. Than they are for organizing their own members or defending their own members. So I think that this thing does have tremendous potential, and any information that you could get to us on this would you get out here. Will you be involved in attending, if possible, that your trial will probably...
It'll be occurring at that time, so yeah. I have to say in all likelihood, no, I will not be attending that. I don't think that I will be able to at all, or maybe even allowed to travel there if I wanted to, if there was a break in the trial. That's true. That's unfortunate, but I know that that critical resistance exists, and they've been having these conferences, and I think they are beginning to get some of their information out. I think something like this would be a great civil rights movement, you know, the prison industrial complex and the way people are being treated and who's criminalized and for what reasons they're criminalized. I like to think that the passage of this Proposition 36 in California is a small step in the right direction, having people go into treatment rather than having, you know, small possession charges. I heard somebody well-known, I won't say his name, on television lately say, oh, I'm not voting for that because that's like legalizing drugs. Well, it doesn't legalize drugs, and alcohol's a drug, you know, and it certainly has done countless harm to people's lives for centuries. And, you know, the best thing you want for an alcoholic is some kind of a treatment and a way to deal with his or her problem and get on with their lives. The same with most of these drugs. We're not talking about big-time dealers here. We're just talking about people with petty possession charges. I also read then the DAs got in and said, well, we used to bust things down. Now we won't as much because of these treatment things. You know, so they always seem to have some kind of response that's negative, that's sort of anti-people. But I think there's more and more recognition that the drug laws in this country are not only out of hand, but that treatment offers a greater percentage of possibility of success for people dealing with their problems, and it's a far cheaper method. The most expensive method of dealing with any of society's problems is to lock people up and take all the money out of all the programs that people really need in our society to make their lives better, the general population, and put them into these prisons and locking people up. And you don't find that in other Western industrialized countries, and you don't find the fact that they have lower crime rates. Violence rates, maybe, because there is a greater use of guns in the United States, and you bring a gun into a crime, and the potential for fallout is huge. But the rate of crime in Western countries isn't smaller, but the rate of incarceration is much tinier. The United States, it's becoming a prison house.
The 2 million... prisoners, it's of course now more since that,
right,
which is 25% of the world's prison population.
Right.
When they talk about, when President Clinton brags about our low unemployment rate, one of the reasons we have, besides the fact that if you have three jobs, you're counted as three people working, which people tend to forget, or work 10 hours a week and you're counted as one person working, those 2 million people come from the working class,
right.
and they would be otherwise
unemployed. So that's one way to deal with them and keep them sort of depressed statistically if they're in prison, and also hide the problems that make people turn to this kind of petty crime because they're living in neighborhoods where there's no hope and there's tremendous desperation. And of course, another thing is it destroys families. The highest growing rate of women are the highest growing percentage of prisoners entering the prison system today, even though men far outnumber them. But who are really taking care of kids in most of these poverty-stricken communities. It's the mothers and their extended family, usually their aunts, their sisters, their mothers. And, you know, these families are just destroyed. And if you're in federal prison, there's no compensation for you when you get out. And the trouble with federal prisoners is there aren't very many federal women's prisons, so they're just shipped anywhere in the country. I spoke to one woman recently who was from the Midwest who did 7 years in Danbury for copying to something that a boyfriend was doing with drugs and took some of the rap for him because he already had some priors, and she ends up with, you know, 7 years in prison, her kids in Iowa. Her sister had a good job and could take care of them, but it was three extra kids, and they gave her no compensation. So what her sister had to do for 7 years was work harder. And so this woman is now involved in a program where they try to at least unite for visits children and inmates in the federal prison system because she knows what it's like personally not to see her children. She's not a recidivist. She's come out. She's working hard, and she's also working passionately on what her volunteer activity is. But in the meantime, she also has to have a job and raise her three kids and is grateful for the opportunity to do so again. But that's 7 years away from her kids when they were young. And these are just people, and they hurt too.
It's interesting but not surprising that in the presidential campaign, none of these issues were even mentioned on the floor between Gore and Bush or Bore and Gush. While we're speaking, and probably, and probably, maybe, even up to your trial time, we may not have a president. Could be a good thing. I'd like to get your comments on what you think of this present situation without a clear choice in our democracy for a president.
Well, I suppose I should be more worried than I am, but and I do find myself, I don't deny it. Whenever I come home, I just run right to the TV and turn it on and see what the newest news is on it. So I'm interested. I'm certainly intrigued by it. It's, I guess, I have to say, what do they expect with those two candidates? Also, you know, I have my preferences, and I'm just going to say I'll prefer Gore to Bush. I won't lie about that. I have been interested in this election, even though sometimes I just think, why bother? But I think one thing that most intrigues me about this whole process is the entrance of Nader into it and the fact that he wasn't even considered worthy of anything. What's more, allowing in the debates, and that includes Buchanan too, because I say, you know, Buchanan had as much right as Nader and in Gore and Bush to be in the debates. And I'd rather have the views of someone like Buchanan debated nationally than just allowed to be commented on by Buchanan and his supporters, by people who can refute things he says, you know. And so I think that suddenly blaming Nader on the liberals' parts for Gore's potential defeat, who knows when we'll know, or maybe victory, you know, they won't blame him for the victory, but they're... I find it really unseemly blaming a man who, in my opinion, who I heard speak in the 70s and who was doing work long before that, to suddenly be blamed for doing what he's always been doing and doing it with great integrity. And I just think that the fault lies elsewhere, and I think people know that. But I found it interesting that my two daughters and their friends kind of, one particularly kind of got passionate about it, was angry that people would vote that were uninformed and tried to be informed herself, started reading the newspapers a lot, and she did this on her own. I didn't ask her. So I found that, I think it's always gratifying when somebody starts paying attention to the world around them, even if her response in some ways was to feel helpless, you know. And she said, I'd love to vote for Nader, but what if Gore doesn't win it? I said, honey, Gore not winning isn't your fault any more than Bush winning is your fault. You know, you have to look at all the people who are involved in this, and they're voting for these people too. And I'm just happy you're interested. And she said, it affects me. I suddenly realize it affects me. Oh, wow. You know, 6 months ago. Huh? So that was kind of interesting.
It would have been much more appreciative on my part if those liberals who are so outraged at people who voted for Nader, as if that might prevent Gore from being president, if they express the same outrage at Nader being denied
absolutely.
A position at the debate.
Yes, absolutely. You know, to me, not allowing the participation of certain candidates, that did surprise me at the time. I thought, well, I guess this is the media blackout. That's all I can attribute it to. The media isn't interested. The only time they became interested is when they thought they smelled a little blood there because there was going to be, because liberals started running ads in swing states. You know, they thought, oh, good, there's going to be a little cat fight here between Gore supporters and Nader supporters. So that was sort of interesting. And then they start covering it. But yes, you know, even the media, they weren't at all. They didn't even report the story, the big story in Boston where Nader tried to get into the debate. And there were lots of demonstrations, a lot of kids demonstrating, or people that, not just children. I know there were union people out there, too, in support of Gore. But that's everybody's right, you know, and they really didn't support that. I heard that whole story on Democracy Now!, which I guess is they're trying to take out, too. Pacifica, you know, is trying to take out a show that hardly has the listenership that anything on the networks has, even people you never heard of, you know, these talking heads that keep popping up and you say, who's that? Oh, well, why worry or be concerned? And that isn't even allowable anymore. Can't even have Amy Goodman on presenting some alternative point of view. What is everybody so afraid of, you know? And then one begins to realize, any ideas. People are afraid of any ideas that go against what is the prevailing ideas we're supposed to think.
You know, it seems to me that the election debate setup between the Republicans and the Democrats seemed to really give credence to those people who say essentially one political party with two different wings of it, with two different styles, but the substance is pretty much the same, that you have the large corporations who give money to both political parties. One, Gore, attacks the corporations, the very corporations that, in fact, are giving him money. Mm-hmm. That's the role he plays, and that it's like a spoil system. Mm-hmm. It's like the Giants playing the Dodgers. They don't want somebody else interfering. And we have all these fans on the outside. I'm a Dodger fan. I want or a football game, instant replay. We have an instant replay going on here in Florida, right?
Right. Yeah.
And fans of one against fans of the other.
Right.
But the people, the fans, have no more choice to pick their teams than they did to pick those people running for office.
Oh, that's absolutely true. You know, I have in the past watched presidential debates. I admit I didn't. You know, I figured if I were interested in anything that might have occurred, I could read it the next day in the Times, and I did. I did. But they were talking about things that didn't really concern me when I think of what, you know, the problems are that the country's facing. And then not honestly talking about issues that they let them touch on a little bit, like the choice issue and abortion. They both just, you know, particularly Bush, whom we know is all about is against it totally, and is on record with that, was allowed to not answer it. Was basically allowed to not answer it, and it worked that way for all of them. So why watch these, you know, prefabricated debates? Because we know that's what they were, and they were only specific issues that they decided they would approach and even make into issues that other people didn't, that the general population didn't consider issues. You know, that most people are concerned about health care and whether or not we have a national health policy. And the only way that's even approached is this prescription drug crisis, which is a crisis for a portion of the population, particularly old people, but for anybody if they have to go and pay for a drug prescription that they do desperately need and don't have health insurance. And even so, the copays are high. But that's the only aspect of it that they would even touch on. They wouldn't touch on the fact that millions of people don't have health insurance and a lot of them are children in poverty, that they don't want that. You know, the insurance companies won't let them go near it. And so that's just one issue right there that wasn't dealt with, that a lot of people are concerned with, not just powerless people either. Your middle class people are concerned with. They can't afford it. It can't keep going on like this, and everybody needs health care. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I can say something like national health insurance, but I don't feel a lot of hope that anything's going to be done about that.
You're talking about socialized medicine.
Well, I know, but I'm not the only one. Even your doctor's talking about it. They're not necessarily socialists. They just see that this is an insurmountable problem and something has to be done. You know, so I know you hear that old phrase, campaign finance reform, and I don't know if it can ever be approached with any kind of meaningful attack, because the people who control the access to that attack won't allow it to happen. I think we all know, unless corporations are taken out of the electoral process, it's just a sham.
Yeah. You know, there's a voice that needs to be heard, and when you win this trial, I know you're going to continue to be an activist. Getting back to your case, I want to have listeners know how they can support the case, how they get information. Maybe, Mary, you can tell us about the website and how people can support Sarah's case.
Sure. What we're looking for people to do is go up on our website, www.saraholsondefense.org, and stay updated, but also write letters of support to your local papers, and write editorials, and send them to us to put up on the website. We need to be able to put that kind of thing up. We're also selling, we're trying to raise money. We're selling T-shirts. We have this new poster, gorgeous silkscreen poster about divesting from the U.S. prison industrial complex. And, of course, we're selling the cookbook, Serving Time, America's Most Wanted Recipes. So if you're looking for Christmas gifts, these holidays, holiday gifts, please come to us. We have lots of things you can give to people. we would really love after this trip. Oh, we're on a tour out here in California now, and we're doing a program at Hastings University. We're going down to Santa Cruz and doing a program. We're going down to San Diego. A lot of the people that have stepped forward to support Sarah are coming from coalition groups that support prisoners and political prisoners. So we've developed a lot of support in the California area. So if people can come out to these programs tomorrow at Hastings University at 3:30. Today, Sarah's going to do a book signing for America's Most Wanted. just check our website and get in contact with us. And if you can have a fundraiser at your home, anything you can do is appreciated.
If people want to send checks, where do they send them?
They can send them to P.O. Box 300-123, Minneapolis, Minnesota 55403.
And made out to?
The Sarah Olson Defense Fund Committee.
I know, thank you. I know. By the time this is broadcast, on Berkeley City Council will be voting on a resolution. Oh, so at the end of this interview, I'll give a live report on how that vote turned out. Barbara, do you want to say something?
Yes. If they'd like to give a tax-exempt donation, there's an address for the National Lawyers Guild in Kansas City where they can send a tax-exempt donation. I don't have the address on me, though.
Okay, thanks very much. And a last word from you, Sarah.
Well, I do want to make it clear that I appreciate the work that Barbara and Mary and people like them have done for me. This committee began while I was in jail. It is apart from me. If I do some work in conjunction with it, it's because upon request to help with something. But I have no control over the money. I have no control over the content of the website. And really, they could make statements I don't necessarily agree with, because the committee can make statements on their own. I'm not saying they necessarily have, but they, you know, it is an organization apart from me for which I'm grateful, just as I am for all the support that people from other organizations have given me. And I think that's important for that to be clear.
Well, thank you, Ed. Look forward to speaking with and seeing you again, and wishing you all the best in the new year.
Oh, yes. I'm going to need it in this new year. I'm lucky I got an extra year, huh?
Thanks again. Bye-bye.